a better way. You don't have to be another face.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. Today is Thursday, March the 21st, 2024. And this is episode 3466 of the Survival Podcast. It's kind of the monster show of the week. We moved it from Friday, so we can't say Friday anymore. And I don't know that it's worth saying Thursday. Who gets excited about Thursday? Well, if you like this episode, if you like these expert council shows, and many of you really seem to, then maybe you do get excited about a Thursday. And you can always listen to it on a Friday if you want to. But, of course, we have Friday flashbacks for you on Friday. So what do we got lined up from the experts today? Well, Dr. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini will talk about how the U.S. is now opposing communism by acting like communists. Acting like Dr. Paul by being communist. Can we change acting like to being like? Otherwise, I completely agree. Andy McCann will talk about getting a good cardio workout when you have injured knees. I'm going to have a little add-on to this. I completely agree with his advice on what to do for cardio, but I want to talk to people out there that maybe are having knee issues. And if the issue's not short-term, as much as I am not a huge fan of modern medicine in so many ways, I've always said, if I have a yield sign on my spleen, please take me to a surgeon. From, you know, if a car wreck, yield sign. Yeah, you know, there's a place for this. And with knees, sometimes, if recovery doesn't eventually come, surgical options actually are something that have to be looked at. There's a reason that athletes have surgeries like that done. Tim Toolman Cook will talk about the EGO brand of tools, EGO. Never heard of this before. Never heard of it. Tim's got some thoughts on it. And then we're going to hear from Joe Brenton on navigation with a map and compass is a skill that everybody should learn, kind of adding on to my thoughts with the series I've been doing on redefining education. I think I'll be doing a new episode of that next week. Doc Bones will talk to us about the ins and outs and advantages and disadvantages of TRT. That is testosterone replacement therapy. Sean Mills will talk about thoughts about grounding. No, not the kind where you walk out in the grass in your bare feet, which is cool. But no, grounding for power when you're adding a new building and running a new electrical line to it that still goes back to the electrical system in the existing building. Should you ground for the new building or let the ground stand where the ground is? As a electrical engineer, Sean will know a little bit about things like that. And then I have a question. It's not really a question. It was more of a statement from a listener and some concerns, but I read a question through it. A gentleman sent me a article out from Science Focus, and it's on intermittent fasting. And the title of the article is Time-Restricted Eating Linked to a 91% Higher Risk of Cardiovascular Death. Okay, the study itself is not worth the pixels it takes up on the screen at this point, which one of the doctors in it says, but the reason I say it is because, well, you know, for me to know about this study, I don't care that it hasn't been peer-reviewed yet. I don't really care about that. I care about my ability to review it. There is no link to the study. There is no way to see what they did, what their methodology was. This study involved 90,000 people. There's no explanation as to how they were selected or is this empirical? This is just dumb. But what they're talking about here is intermittent fasting. But the question that comes through from the person that sent it to me is, you know, I'm like 160 pounds. I'm a bit of an older guy. It's hard for me to keep weight on as it is. If I live this way, it would be harder. I think he actually has been doing it, and he got down to a healthy weight. But now he's like, maybe I don't need to lose any more weight. Well, I agree. So I'm going to talk about this two ways. One, how bullshit like this spreads across the interwebs and why it should be largely ignored, especially when it's this bad, and how to detect that very, very quickly for yourself so you don't just grab a headline and freak out or grab a headline and have your perception bias become your confirmation bias. Like, so this could have said that it worked, that it was a great thing. It would still be garbage because it's garbage. It's garbage no matter what. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about, like, what do you do if you have been using intermittent fasting or keto or paleo or primal, and you feel like, you know, I don't really want to drop any more weight at all, what do you do? Well, you eat more, but we'll talk about how that might look in this instance. And we'll also talk about the fact that, you know, I'm not saying there is because I don't know, but you could be in that situation and there could be another reason for weight loss. And I hate to bring the C word into this, but often people who feel that they're living a very healthy life, when they are starting to lose weight beyond what seems reasonable for their lifestyle, you can sometimes find that through a cancer that is basically stealing nutrient from the body. So you may want to get, you know, there's now like a blood panel that tests for like almost all the cancers that exist, just to be safe. And I'll talk more about that, reminding everyone, of course, that while we do have two doctors on the expert council, I am not one of them. So I am speaking as a layman in this, but a layman who has, you know, talked to an awful lot of people dealing with an awful lot of different things. And, you know, by gathering data, you can make some reasonable things that you might want to at least concern yourself with. Now, I want to say something else about expert council shows. As always, if you have a question for the members of the expert council, please send it to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. TSPC in the subject line for any email you send me. If it's an expert council question, though, how about TSPC, like it's a word, space, expert, and then I will know what I'm looking at, and I will find it if it goes in the spam folder, and I will send it to the appropriate expert panel member. My question is, this is how you send me a question. My question is for expert panel member, fill in the blank. Please don't put fill in the blank there. I will delete your email. I will not see this joke. I will delete it. I don't have time. I don't have time. And then hit return. And then my question is, state your question the same way I ask you to state them for me. One sentence with a question mark. Return. Put some space in there. Don't give me a giant glob of text I can't read. And then give me any details you feel that are relevant. If you do that, I'll know what you're asking. They'll know what you're asking. And it'll make sense to me whether it makes sense to send it to them or not. And you will most likely get an answer. Now, I want to say something else about expert counsel. Jack screwed up. Jack was wrong. I don't know exactly how you put this, but we have three new awesome expert council members. Andy McCann from CrossFit Garage, Joe Brenton, who you're going to hear from today, and we also have Eric Hammond, who has been doing a great job for us with stuff that, like, of mechanical nature, specifically vehicles and mechanics, which, you know, we had a great mechanic at one time, Humble Mechanic, and he just too busy to also do this, so we've kind of been missing that. So I'm really glad to have these three guys. They are not on Meet the Expert Council yet. And I have been sitting here tapping my fingers going, what the hell? Okay, what the hell? I asked you guys for a headshot and a bio, and two of the three sent it in, and not wanting to be a dick and wanting to do everybody at once, I've been waiting for the third guy. Because if you're going to be on the expert council, then I expect you to take initiative or you can't be. And I was like, you know, maybe I just need to take the two that sent me the bio and the headshot and put them on the page. And then I found today in the wrong folder, Jack, because you put it there, that the person that I thought was holding out was actually not only not holding out, they were actually the first person who sent me their bio and their pictures. So between today, tomorrow, the weekend, I will get all three of them added to the Expert Council Meet Us page, and I will make a formal announcement. But they are all officially members of the Expert Council now. So again, new members of the council, Andy McCann on CrossFit and Fitness, Joe Brenton on all types of outdoor stuff. Like today is about navigation with a map and compass, kind of filling in for the loss of Dixie Mills, who is off getting married and having babies and has other things in her life to do other than be on my expert council now. And then, of course, we also have Eric Hammond on the mechanical stuff. So if you want to know all the other expert council members and the things that they can answer for you, if you go to the About tab at thesurvivalpodcast.com, you'll see one of the subpages is Meet the Expert Council, and there are links to all of their stuff in every episode on the Expert Council as well. So with that, a little longer intro than typical because I owe it to the gentleman who I won't name because he was never wrong in the first place to state that it is my fault that we have not gotten this done quicker. 100% on me. I apologize. With that, let's hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on how the U.S. is opposing communism by, in my words, being communists.
I don't voluntarily and or often go to talking about a certain senator because he could take care of himself and I don't have to. But I am going to mention Rand today because he's really been outspoken on this issue of TikTok. And you say, well, what does he know about that? And people are furious because he's the only one that probably intends to even vote against it. So, but it passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives. TikTok now is in the middle of a scandal because the American people, generally speaking, and the bias, both Democrats and Republicans, but especially Republicans, boy, it's dangerous. China's coming in here. They're about to take over. Our empire is going to be broken up, and they're scare tactics, and they say, boy, we have to get rid of it. So we're going to put a ban on it. We don't let you use it.
You should be a very proud father because Senator Rand Paul really is a champion of our civil liberties, the Bill of Rights. He's, when it's the big stuff, when the rubber hits the road, he is always there, even by himself, defending us. And this week he said, you know, regarding this TikTok, great quote, emulating Chinese communism is not the way to combat Chinese communism. What a radical idea. Don't be a commie yourself. Now, personally, I don't think Chinese communism has to be battled at all. What do I care? I'm 6,000 miles away. I'm an American. What do I care what kind of government they have all the way across the world? Let each nation choose their own form of government. I definitely don't want our government to be communist. And, you know, thank goodness, even though they're leaning in that direction, they're not communists. And I don't really care if San Francisco or New York City, if they want to live the way they live, knock yourself out. And so this whole battling communism is not really necessary. And if you look, like Dr. Paul said, if you look at China, they're pretty much communist in name only. They are some of the biggest, most powerful capitalists in the world. Now, we Americans, oh, we're the capitalists. That's pretty much in name only. We're some of the biggest socialists in the world. But the point that Rand is making, and it's a wonderful point, is you're not going to defeat this bad ideology by adopting it yourself. You're going to censor people. You're going to give the president this terrible power of saying they're foreign influence, that's it, censor them. Even though 100 million Americans use their service, and this whole idea that China is coming to get us, you know, when you look at a map, China is surrounded by U.S. military bases. Are we surrounded by Chinese military bases? Not at all. If anybody should be worried, it's them. You know, and we say over and over, bring our troops home, bring our troops home. But, you know, the American people are so propagandized that this is a very tough battle to fight, to advocate for freedom. That's why Rand is largely alone, because the propaganda is so effective on the American people that they think that they have the right to go tell people all the way around the world how they should live.
The people are lining up, and they have to demonize somebody. And right now, they have been working very hard at it to demonize China, of course, Russia. And this will add fuel to the fire and make it even worse. But if you ever look at one of Rand's points was, He had a lot of trouble with Kilmeade on Fox. He says, who do you think owns it? And ran out a list of the stockholders that owned it, and they weren't all, and none of them were Chinese officials. You know, there were even Americans owned some of this stock.
Unfortunately, Dr. Paul, Americans, we have a bad habit of becoming that which we fight against. So this new, you know, you don't battle communism with communism. This is not something new. You can go back to the Soviet era, and you have the conservative, so-called conservative, not really conservative, Bill Buckley, National Review, and during that time he said, quote, we have got to accept the big government for the duration, for neither an offensive nor defensive war can be waged except through the instrumentality of a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores. So this conservative, quote unquote, was calling for a totalitarian bureaucracy here in America in order to battle the Soviets. And that's what we did. We've got the FBI, the NSA, the CIA. We've got agencies galore. And look, That's what we're stuck with now. Not only are they used overseas, they're now turned inward on us. Okay, that's what happens when you create this totalitarianism to battle totalitarianism out there. The same with this war on terror. Look who suffered as a result of it with the Patriot Act, with surveillance on us, with the ridiculous TSA where you stand for an hour to take your shoes off to get groped. Meanwhile, look at the border, and people are walking in with their shoes on, as best as I can tell, bringing in whatever they want, and that's it. And meanwhile, we're standing, taking our shoes off, and getting groped. So do you see how you do not battle wrong by doing the wrong things? You don't battle tyranny by becoming a tyrant yourself.
You know, they hit on it a little bit, but they really didn't drive the nail home with where the bigger problem is here. Let me just say, I am not for the censorship of any website or app at all, period, infinity. But I can look at degrees of bad. So the government with this is doing the same thing the government always does. You name and act something, or even if it's not named that, you call it that in the media, as though that is the thing the act does, so that it can be passed into a law, and the law does something totally divorced from the name. You know, in The Simpsons, at one point, they did a number on this. They did a really good job with it, and they called the bill the Flower for Orphans bill. If you've ever heard me say that, that's the pop culture reference I'm making. If this was a TikTok ban, it would be the bill could be two pages at most, maybe three on the long shot. And it would say that TikTok itself represents a threat to the United States, blahzy, blahzy, blah. And then it would say that unless TikTok is sold to a U.S.-controlled entity because it is a threat, we want it banned. And then the president would sign it. It would be a single-case law for a single-case thing. And if you wanted to do it again in the future, you would have to go through all this rigmarole to do it again. To be clear, for the special learners in my audience, because some of you are here, and I don't know why, there are people that listen to this show every day so that they can say, ah, gotcha. I am not saying that would be okay. I'm saying degrees of bad, that would be to the lesser of the degrees of bad from what this is. That is not what this is. I don't care what the TV tells you. I don't care what the right-wing fascist shitbags say on right-wing radio. They are just as wrong in this as anybody else, okay? Just because they're right more often than the left, it does not mean that they're right all the time, and they're damn wrong here. That would be wrong, but it is what it is. What this bill actually does is it creates an entire new power that is permanent at the executive branch under the purview of the President of the United States for all eternity that doesn't ever have to go through this process again. It basically says the president can determine that any of these websites, apps, any kind of social media, any of it, is at the behest of a foreign entity. And if so, they can do the same thing to that one. So, you know, there are some foreign investors in X, Twitter, right? So if that exceeds, I think it's 20% in the bill, then it could be deemed as that. And you know how they twist this shit anyway. Well, this, you know, entity is controlled by this entity, and this entity may be associated with this entity, and I don't like it, and it's interfering with our election. So, Elon Musk, you have to sell X to a full U.S.-controlled entity, or we're going to ban X, right? Or any other platform, any other news source, any other anything, because it does not specify social media. It could be a website that is a news website like, oh, I don't fucking know. How about RT.com? Right? This is bullshit. This is bullshit. If TikTok actually represents the threat that it does, then why can't your government do what it never does here and write a simple bill that is limited to the scope of the current issue rather than grant an incredibly bad new power to the executive branch? As though they are doing it temporarily when they are doing it permanently. You've been lied to again. These people are scum. The media is scum. Do you know that one of the Supreme Court justices, King T. Jackson, right, just stated in Supreme Court arguments, look it up if you doubt me, The First Amendment is getting in the way of the ability of the government to censor things on social media. Getting in the way. It's supposed to get in the fucking way. How did you get a degree in law? How did you pass the bar? Oh, maybe you went, I don't know, did you come up in a state where you don't have to pass the bar anymore? Oh, no, that couldn't apply to you. Did you cheat on the bar? I mean, really, do you not understand the entire purpose of the Bill of Rights is the restriction of government? We're throwing everything away. Let me tell you how bad this is getting with the shit that's going on. I mentioned this earlier, a couple weeks ago, that my wife started talking about we needed a community, like we've always talked about. She's never been all in on it. You know what she started talking about this week? This is making me nervous. This sounds like what my father told me about Germany. Maybe we need to get the fuck out of this country altogether. That's my wife. That's how bad this shit is. My wife doesn't think that way, and my wife doesn't talk that way. This is absolutely horrifying. We have people that are being protected while breaking the law and people being prosecuted who aren't. This is a police state. You are sitting in the middle of a banana republic. And it may get to a point where it is time to hit, if you can, the eject button. But at least get the hell away from these places like New York. Get away from these places like, you know, Seattle, Washington. Get away from these places like Los Angeles. Get away from these places. Because the hope is that they can destroy themselves so badly that the rest of the country wakes the fuck up. All right, I didn't mean to get on a soapbox there, but damn. All right, moving on. How about bad knees and cardio? Let's hear from Andy McCann.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage out here in Woodstock, Georgia. And this question from Eric is actually near and dear to my heart. Basically, he's asking, how do I work out with a messed up knee? So his question, what exercises or program do you recommend for cardiovascular health for someone with bad knees? I've been very active my whole life, but after my third knee surgery, I've slowed down. If I keep doing this, I'm going to get messed up and have to have a fourth surgery or a knee replacement. Any impact exercise such as jogging causes my knees to swell up. Years of hiking steep grades has deteriorated my cartilage in my knee, in my kneecap, so deep squats are problematic. Thanks in advance. Okay, so I too have a messed up knee. I was racing in a race. I was fit enough when my feet were clipped into the bike to get out of the clips. You twist your leg sideways. I twisted my knee right off, and I heard this. I'm like, I think I just ripped my meniscus up. And I did. I never got surgery, and I kept doing my stuff. And this is what I did, and here's the things that I would recommend. So I am living your life, but I am very good with long suffering. So I just took it and just did the smart things, as listen to my body. Anyway, here's what we do. All right, first, so Survival Podcast Community, I'm going to throw you at links. I don't have any links that I am really associated with. It's just junk that I've actually used. So first, cardiovascular health. You guys, what he's asking is, hey, how do I help my heart? Right? It's heart disease, heart attack, strokes, all that stuff. So we're going to go down that. Also, what about my knee? Also, exercises and programs. All right, you can go to the CDC, everyone's yay favorite site, and really look some answers up, but they do have good information. All right, I have lived this life. I want to give you, I'm on my YouTube page, it's Andy McCann 42, and here is me doing, I don't know if the sound's going to come through, I hope not, but here's me doing a squat clean with a torn meniscus, and the doctor said, your meniscus is torn, we should do surgery. I said, hey, hold my beer, let me try some stuff. So here I am, I don't know, like 6 years later. And basically you're just going to watch me do
can't touch this.
A deep squat snatch. Yay. So it is possible. I am living proof. All right. So first you asked what exercise or exercise program would I do. I really like this right here. This is a CrossFit linchpin. It's a fellow. Let's see, I got a picture of him right here. And he's an OG CrossFitter. And his tagline is developing a program for those that want to maintain their back, their knees, and their shoulders and still want to be fit. So I love what he's doing. It is very low impact. It's just kind on those body parts. So if you're looking for a program, if you just want something to follow, buy his stuff, pay him to help you out. If you want to shortcut the process, hire a mentor. He'd be your mentor. He's got a great community. I listen to his podcast. I actually listen to both his podcasts. The guy's awesome. The next thing is this dude right here, the knees over toe guy. I actually did some of his stuff. I'm going to say it wasn't awesome for a torn meniscus. I think his slant is really more for MCL, ACL, that type of thing. though I did use it, and I had other guys in my gym who had knee issues, and we used it together, actually in my workout routine for about a year, I would do some of his programs. Again, I would buy his thing and then just follow it. Yeah, you could probably go find it online for free from somebody else, but dude, this guy wants to make some money somehow, and he's got great information. Look at his knees, look what he did. So follow his story. This guy's awesome. Pay him his $50, get his information. The knees over toe guy, he's got great stretches. And so it's and exercises that you could do. Okay, so that is exercises and programs. These are two guys that you can really drill into. They're going to teach you what to do for and helping your knees and backs just stay in better health. I love it. People should probably follow this ahead of time. Now you asked, what about exercises specifically for cardiovascular with this bad knee? All right, you're going to hate this. Well, one, the linchpin, that's a great way to go. But let's see, do I have... No, there it is right there. So picture of the Rogue Echo bike. Hello, no impact on your knees, and this is going to crush your soul in many ways. We've got 10 of these in the gym, and anytime this comes up and it's 4 calories, like do it hard, people are like moaning and crying. This guy right here will help you find the nasty room. Knock on the door for sure, but don't go in. You're on pedals, so you're not doing that impact, so the grind is away. But you can keep your cardio side up. Now, you can do a lot of different things. You just get on the bike and go for like 20 minutes. Yay, go dog, you're moving the needle. Or you can do a Tabata style where you do 20 seconds of work and 10 seconds of rest, and you blow it out of the water in those 20 seconds. Go nice and easy. Figure out what your knee is going to do on this. You can buy this piece of equipment, put it in your house, no problem. You probably have local gyms that have it. That's awesome, right? I like this one because it is super rugged. You can get other types of bikes. I just really like these. There's literally no way for this ape, me, to break this thing. It's made like a tank, and it's awesome. The other one are these Concept 2 rowerg. I don't know why I call it a rowerg, but we use these a lot. This is what I do at home with my bad knee. Some days I own a gym, and some days I can't make it to the gym. I know, that's crazy. I own it, and all the broken pieces are in my basement, so I could just literally just work out in my basement, but I don't usually. If I'm going to do something, I go for a jog. If my knee's not feeling it, I do. I get my playlist on my phone and turn on Spotify, hit go, and for one song I bike, and the other song I row, and I just go back and forth for about 20 or 30 minutes. My warm-up and my cool-down is part of the workout. It's going to move the needle fantastically. The other thing is, you don't have to do distance for cardio. I said this on another episode. I don't know how these will come out for Jack, but if you want to, well, the best thing you do is get some strength on you. If you want to gain some cardio while doing strength, just do lighter and go more reps, right? And just do it faster. So if you have to catch your breath, you're going into the cardio side. You don't have to do a lot of crazy stuff. Now, you did say in here that deep squats are problematic. Here's what I would suggest to you is do some squat therapy. And if you go Google it, do CrossFit squat therapy, you're going to see them using a door jam to help themselves get down. You don't want to lose mobility. And if you can increase the blood flow to your knee area, which doesn't have much blood flow anyway, it could help rebuild some of that area. So I did some PRP, platelet-rich plasma. They take your blood out, they spin it, and they shoot it back in your knee. That felt great for about a week and then went away. So I did that 3 times. I don't have great insurance because I work for myself. So I just basically paid $1,000 per shot. And you know, he was my mentor. He was my the coach. I paid the coach's money, and it did work for a little bit of time. What really did it, I think, was going below parallel in a squat in a very smart manner. So if I did box steps, it hurt. If I went upstairs, it hurt. If I tried to do jump rope, it hurt. So you know what I didn't do? Those things. But anytime they came up, I would do slow, deep, methodical squats using the rig or door jam or whatever to help me go down and help me go up. So I was trying to understand where that pain and the problems were and to see if I did move the joint, could I add blood there so that it would start repairing? And as you tear things down in your body, it will want to build things back up. So that's what I would do. And I'm going to reread your question, see if I missed anything. No, it looks good. And I will say this, my dad had double knee replacement surgery. Best thing that he ever did. His knees were pretty jacked up from being a kid, and he has gained a lot of mobility in life out of new knees. So don't be afraid of the knees. They've come a long way, and if this is where you're at, I mean, that's probably where you're at. But I would do the other things first. Go au natural and really listen to your body. All right, Eric, hopefully that helped. If you need me, you can hit me at andymccann@crossfitgarage.com. You guys can listen to this and other podcasts that I've done. Thank you, Jack, you jerk. That is called CrossFit Garage on podcast, you know, any service. And our aim there is to help you build a firm foundation in fitness, food, and finances. All right, guys, take care.
So first of all, Andy did send me a couple links that I included in the show notes today on the two pieces of equipment he mentioned, one being a bike and the other one being a rowing machine. I want to say something about that. Personally, I find bikes to be the most boring form of exercise, stationary bikes, I should say. And I've tried the whole, Peloton type shit, it's just the most boring damn thing in the world. But it works, and if it works for you, then great. But I, even really trying, have never been able to get a great cardio workout on a stationary bike without getting up off the saddle and getting into that kind of like that pump and run position on a bike, which may be really negative for somebody with knee problems. So it depends on how bad the knee problem is, and maybe it's something that you work yourself into, and that would be good, because if you can recover without surgery, you should. I want to talk, though, about rowing machines. I don't own one. If I wanted a machine that would give me the ultimate cardio workout with low impact, it's what I would buy. When I used to go to the gym and go to clubs and stuff, it was the main machine that I would use. And I will tell you that I have never, on any piece of equipment anyway, ever had anything that is a heavier cardiovascular workout. I've heard people talk about Stairmasters and all. I used to get on Stairmasters and just, I would get bored, you know, it could just keep going and, you know, stuff where it speeds up, slows down, wears you out, whatever, like, no problem. A rowing machine used properly, to me, the only time I've ever had a heavier, like, beating heart in doing something physical is like shoveling coal with a number 10 coal shovel, which if you don't know what that means, you can't really appreciate what I'm talking about. It is a fantastic workout. And as I said, I am all for recovering from injury and problems without surgery. I do think when it comes to things, especially like knees, which is a structural thing that like your entire body depends on your knees so you can even just walk, let alone run or jump or whatever. If you do not start to see progress, I think it is time to consult with somebody about whether or not surgery is an option. It doesn't mean you should do it, but you should maybe start at least looking at it, maybe have an MRI done or something. What is the problem? What is the mechanical problem? Now, I had a very bad knee injury a few years ago, more than a few years ago now. It was an MCL, LCL issue, both of them at the same time. And it was the kind of thing that you're told you need surgery for this. And it took about 6 months to get complete recovery. It took about 3 to get decent recovery. But had that progression not occurred, then I would have sought other options. Okay. And I think that there needs to be a point where if the progress isn't coming and if the injury is becoming worse, then sometimes the knife is the right tool for the job. Surgeons do, but I think they're way too quick to cut. So you got to balance that. The other thing I'll say is if you have a knee injury like this, you should be wearing a knee brace most of the time during the day. You can take it off so that it feels better and whatever, but like especially if you're walking and whatever, you know, take it off when you're seated, that type of thing, until you recover. And the other thing is you should be using, whether it's Dr. Christopher's Tissue and Bone or you know, the stuff you make yourself, some form of comfrey slathered on that knee at least a couple times a day, because it does work. It is a big part of how I recovered from my knee injury. And it is, you know, there's a zero risk associated with that. So if something can help but can't hurt, it's probably a good idea to do. Also, cold and warm therapy. So heating pad followed by ice, followed by heating pad, followed by ice, maybe 5 to 10 minutes each, and then doing that. And what you're doing there, and this is something that doctors, in my opinion, do not advise enough on this, and it's stuff I've learned from Ken Berry, is that when you have these tendon ligament style injuries, one of the biggest problems that you have is there's not much blood flow to those. They're more mechanical than they are biological, I guess would be a way to put it, but that's not accurate. All I'm saying is that your ligaments, your tendons do not get the blood flow that your muscles do. And because of that, it takes them a lot longer to heal. And whatever we can do to increase blood flow to the area is a good idea. And cold, warm does that. As will comfrey. Comfrey does a lot of things with, it's a dermal regenerator. Its folk medicine name is bone knit. So it is very restorative. But it also does create, when you use it consistently on an area, a better flow of blood. So, anyway, I'm sure somebody will write me and tell me I'm wrong about that, but they will have no basis in fact whatsoever. And let's move on from, let's hear from Tim Toolman Cook on ego, not the kind in your head, a brand of power tools.
Hey guys, Toolman Tim here, coming back at you from the workshop where we create community, find freedom, promote preparedness, and share success. Back to tackle another segment for the Expert Council, so let's dive right in. This one says, question for Toolman Tim. Is the Ego brand 56-volt lithium-ion tool system worthy of investment and standardization? Details. My wife bought me a new Ego Arc 18-inch chainsaw for Christmas. I've used it exactly once, and I'm impressed with its power while the battery lasts. The package notes that all Ego batteries power all Ego tools. So I wonder, is this a brand worthy of standardizing across my power tools? Thanks, Creighton. Well, let's talk about it, because I've had some experience with Ego recently. So last summer, I split my handyman business, All Seasons Maintenance, into Toolman Tim's Property Management, and I sold off the mow and snow portion to a local guy. He kept the name All Seasons, and with that sale, all of my gas-powered mow and snow gear went with it. I kept my DeWalt cordless landscaping gear and the push mowers because I wanted to see how they last long term, but I needed some replacement snow removal gear. Now, since I'm only clearing our snow and my rental across the street, I wanted to go with battery. Now, I couldn't go with battery when I was running the company because I did 30-some properties and the battery just wouldn't last. Now, as far as the push mower or the push snowblower, I went with a single-stage DeWalt snowblower, which I'm happy with, despite its rather hefty price tag. Now, importantly to this question, I replaced my steel gas-powered backpack blower with an Ego 56-volt backpack blower, and it's blown me off my feet. Pardon the dad joke. But it isn't quite as powerful as the top-of-the-line steel. But man, it's handled the few snows we've had, and it can manage up to about 4 inches of snow. I've been really, really impressed. It has tons of power. The runtime is more than exceptional for what I need. It's quiet enough that you could go out early in the morning and not tick off your neighbors. And it's well built. It just feels substantial when you pick it up. It's honestly had me second-guessing myself on the DeWalt snowblower, as every time I go into my local Rona, I've been eyeing up those Ego snowblowers that they have. They have single-stage and double-stage, two-stage. The thing is, they're just a well-built machine. Anything of theirs you pick up, it feels really good. It looks good, and it performs really well. It just doesn't have the name recognition that a lot of the major players in that field have. They have probably the best lineup, or one of the best lineups, of outdoor tools for battery-powered gear on the market right now. Now, here's the thing. Here's where you need to consider. If you mostly just do outdoor work, then Ego could definitely be a brand for you. They have everything. They've got zero-turn mowers, single and dual-stage snowblowers. They got backpack and handheld blowers, and they got an assortment of pole saws, hedge trimmers, and push mowers. So they've got everything the big boys have. What they don't have is a lot of construction or any kind of hand tools, or not a lot anyhow. And plus, those batteries would be big and beefy for that kind of thing. Now, here's one other thought when you're looking at this, and it's good to run the numbers so that we can see whether it's worth it or not. But for me, with all my DeWalt gear, having extra batteries is a must. And it's a must on any and all platforms. Now, the thing is, the replacement batteries aren't cheap. They're big, but in my head, I always thought those 56 volts were a lot more expensive. So I decided to run the numbers and see how do they compare with DeWalt batteries, for instance. So what I found was on Lowe's.com, a two-pack of 5-amp-hour, 56-volt, Ego brand batteries is $450. So per battery, you're going to get around 280 watt hours for $225 US, or 80 cents a watt hour. Okay, a two-pack of 60-volt DeWalt batteries listed at 9 amp hours. However, those FlexVolt batteries are tricky, And I don't have a problem with how they list them, but that 9 amp hours is actually at 20 volts. So it's only 3 amp hours at 60 volts. So that means you're going to you pay $300 for a 2-pack. You're getting 180 watt hours per battery, or 83 cents a watt hour. So even though the Ego batteries look expensive, the per watt hour breakdown is actually a little bit cheaper. So really, price is about the same. But like I said, it always depends on brands like this. So if you're looking at doing mostly mow and snow work, outside landscaping, that sort of thing, then I absolutely would consider Ego. And, you know, if somebody held a gun to my head tomorrow and said, Tim, you have to start a mow and snow business and you have to use all battery gear, I think I'd probably go with Ego at this point, even though you know and everyone else knows that I do love black and yellow. So I hope that helps. I'd love to hear more. Follow up with me and let me know how you end up, what you end up doing with the Ego brand, because they're really making a name for themselves. And it's one of those kind of sleeper companies that not everybody thinks about. So anyway, guys, appreciate these questions. These are some of my favorite to answer. You guys have sent me some good challenging questions this last section, so keep them coming. Send me questions about tools, about generators, backup power, entrepreneurship, the poverty mindset, building off-grid properties, anything and everything. And if you want to keep up with what I'm up to, go by the workshop on YouTube and come by Thursday and Sunday evenings, 6 p.m. Mountain Time, for Workshop Radio. Thursdays we do This Week in Prepping, and Sundays we do an interview with people from around the preparedness world. So guys, as always, stay happy, stay healthy, and have a great week.
So I learned something. I had no idea that this brand was good. I had no idea what this brand was about. And my view of it when the question came in was that it would be a brand with things like drills and saws and stuff like that. And I was like, no, just no. Just out of hand. I am a DeWalt fan, so is Tim. And I didn't research it because it was for Tim. So when you have an expert panel, you send them the thing and you let them do the thing. I probably won't use this brand. I can't see coming off black and yellow. The only yard power tool that we really use is a weed whacker, right? And we have a great DeWalt tool. I have an aftermarket head on it that Tim recommended, and it does everything that we need to do, and I have power for everything. If I was, you know, doing work like this all the time, I would take a serious look at this. If I was a residential homeowner with a quarter acre lot and I was, you know, routinely, you know, pruning trees and mowing grass and stuff at that level, or doing it maybe even small scale commercial, I would look at this hard. I really love electric power tools all around over cordless power tools over plug-ins, but I like them over gas-powered equipment as well. You know, when you look at something like a mower, you know, you say, well, how much a battery is? Well, how much is the gas? And I know you have to pay for it. I always say it, electricity doesn't come from a jelly bean field. You have to pay for the power too, but the power payback is there. So this is a cool thing. I looked up the line itself on Amazon. I have a link right under Tim's segment in the show notes if you want to check it out and learn more about it. Again, I probably won't be doing it, but I don't have the application. And I think that's kind of the bigger point here. Like, there's so many questions. Is this thing good? Well, what's the context? And I'm going to be trying to speak to context more, maybe not more than I have in the past. I've always done it, but kind of pointing out when I'm doing it. You know, as I'm building this course right now on cover cropping, I realized like I needed an entire segment just on context, because the way people ask the question, such as, well, what is this power tool line good, or, you know, what seed mix do I make, it often lacks the context, because the context is what's always unique to the individual asking the question. So we speak in the macro, but then you have to drill down to the micro. And the way that we do that is through context. Anyway, next up, let's hear about navigation with a map and a compass from Joe Brenton.
Hey, folks, it's Joe with Three Peaks Navigation with a expert council segment today, actually inspired by Jack and his current, ongoing redefining education segment. was thinking about what we do at Three Peaks, and honestly, I think being able to navigate with a paper map and a magnetic compass is a skill that everybody should have. It's actually something we've started to teach our kids at an early age. It's not too hard to pick up, and it's just one of those things that you need to practice from time to time. So being able to navigate really requires two tools. You need a compass of some kind and a map of some kind. When we think about compasses, I think a lot of us, you know, think about a lensetic compass maybe we used in the military, or a Silver Ranger or a backpacking compass of some kind, or maybe a little clipper compass we have attached to our watch. Those are all tools that have a piece of metal inside them that's been magnetized, and they point towards magnetic north. The tricky part is that magnetic north is not the same as true north, or what's up, you know, on a map or at the top of the map or at the top of the globe. Magnetic north is actually somewhere over Greenland, and it actually moves over time. And so when I am using a magnetic compass to navigate, I need to know what the declination is, or the distance between true north and magnetic north, and either compensate for that in my brain or buy a compass like a Silver Ranger that will allow me to adjust it so it does the compensation for me. If I'm using a digital compass, maybe a GPS-enabled watch or a phone, those are going to give me true north bearings, not magnetic north bearings. So, you know, this is obviously something we could spend a lot more time talking about. The bottom line here is you need to understand if the compass you're using is providing you true or magnetic readings. So second part of this is obviously a map. Paper maps are getting a lot more hard to find. It used to be that you could get a USGS 7.5-minute topographic quad map for anywhere in the United States. Those are still being printed on a limited basis, but they are not updated at the frequency that a lot of the online mapping programs and mapping data repositories are being updated. I'm sure many of us remember pulling out a Thomas guide or keeping that in the car to navigate. You know, those days are long gone as well. If you did want to buy a map right now, I would recommend looking for a DeLorme, Atlas, and Gazetteer. DeLorme is the name of the company. It's an atlas that's about 11 by 17, and they're actually made for every state. And so we've got one of those in the car. Usually it's just stashed under the seat, but it provides good topographic or terrain data, as well as roads and trails and Forest Service roads and, you know, all the features you would expect on a map. It doesn't get used very often, but it's a handy resource if you end up in a place that doesn't have cell coverage. So let's put this together and talk a little bit about navigating. And whenever I teach this for the first time, it sounds very simplistic, but what you want to do is grab your map and your compass and identify which way north is. Ideally, I like to face towards north and then turn my map so it's also facing north. I then want to look at the map and look at what's in front of me and identify features that match. It could be very simplistic, like a road with a label, so you see the street in front of you and you know that's a match. It could be a topographic feature like a ridge or a wash. It could be a river or a lake. But honestly, I like to say the trick to not getting lost is constantly comparing what you're seeing with the map and what you're seeing in front of you and validating that those match. As you gather more experience and you know, get more time practicing this sort of thing, you'll start to anticipate what it is you're going to see in the future. If I'm hiking down a trail, I'll look at a map and, you know, see that in about a mile, I'm going to cross a creek, and I know it's going to take me about 20 minutes to hike that far. After 25 or 30 minutes, if I haven't crossed that creek yet, I'm probably going to stop and, you know, evaluate whether I'm in the wrong spot, or maybe the creek just dried up because it's August. And so again, it sounds a little simplistic, but the key here is practicing. Obviously doing this, you know, as you're navigating in the city is a lot easier than navigating on a trail or navigating cross country. So, you know, to wrap up, I think I have a challenge for everybody. The next time you're planning a trip, whether it's across town or maybe, you know, to a different state, think about how you would do it if you didn't have digital resources. Maybe you go old school and you look up the directions and print them out ahead of time like we used to do. Or maybe you use dead reckoning. You know, there's a lot of different analog methods you can use to navigate. And I'm the first to admit, I use my phone all the time to navigate, whether it's in the backcountry or, you know, just to get across town and dodge traffic. So I'm definitely someone that is dependent on digital methods from time to time, but I do like to practice those analog skills and sharpen those skills up. You know, if you're interested in more topics like this, you can check out Three Peaks Navigation on Instagram and YouTube. It's a new community I'm building where we talk about analog and digital tools for navigating in the backcountry. I'm also excited to answer your expert council questions about anything to do with the outdoors, from day hikes to backpacking trips, skiing to kayaking, whether it's helping choose a new piece of gear or the best snack to get a toddler hiking down the trail, send the questions my way. Thanks again and have a great day.
So not really an ad, but more of like an additional take is that we have become over dependent on technology, and you know, a good magnetic compass and a map are not subject to like a signal going down or simply being somewhere that you're not getting signal, but they're also not subject to they're certainly subject to error in the operator, but they're not really subject to error in the technology themselves. I guess there are some things you can screw up a compass, but here's what I mean. Like, we have become so dependent on the fact that we have an app on our phone and we can say, and stick an address in and say, you know, see like three routes, pick the one we want, click on it and say go, that we have stopped learning the skill of even basic navigation. We're really talking about orienteering here in Joe's segment, and I'm all for it, but I'm also saying there's like another level of this, and that is that we should at least be able to do things like use a regular map to figure out where we're going. And I mean like on streets, not necessarily where you need a compass and shooting an azimuth and a back azimuth and triangulation and all this other shit. Like, we should be able to do what everybody did, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago and back. When I was working in sales in Dallas-Fort Worth, I had a Mapsco, right? And I don't remember what it was called, but there was a cheaper version of it that was just as good as like half the price. They didn't have their own stores. And I had that. I had one for the Fort Worth side and one for the Dallas side. And I could get to any job site, any customer site, anything I wanted with that. Most people today can't do it. And the other thing we need to do is I don't hate technology. And if we're going to rely on technology, we should know how to use technology to verify technology. This is what I mean. When we are going to go on a vacation to a place I've never been before, I pull up, you know, Google Maps and I look at everything on a computer and I get a bearing in my mind. If we're flying into an airport, where is the airport? Where is the rental car? Where is the main highway, so that if I get there and the GPS in my phone or whatever throws a hissy fit, I still have some idea where I am. And it also makes obeying the GPS when it's right easier to do, because sometimes the images on the screen or the instructions don't really make a lot of sense with what you're seeing on the road. They've gotten better and better, which is why people depend on them more. But here's a very recent example of exactly this. My family loves a place called Topgolf. You go hit, it's like a driving range, but it's like three levels, and they have nice adult beverages and kid beverages and some decent, I would call it junk food. But it's like pub food and a little bit elevated from pub food. It's not bad. And golf isn't my thing, and hitting golf balls, but I'll go. And my wife wanted to go recently for her birthday. Well, my grandson loves the place too, so a couple months ago we went for his birthday. And I did what everybody does. I put Topgolf in the map app on my phone and clicked go, and it said do this, and I know the area, so great. And you get off I-30, for me, heading east, and you go I-35W north, and you get on the access road, and then it's right there. And yes, you do all that. And it, because it's a big facility, you can look, and it's right there. And there is no effing way to get to it. It is you end up making like 75 U-turns and finally finding your way over. You can't be, it cannot be done the way the damn phone says. So when we were going again, I got on Google Maps and looked at it and figured out a different route to take. And then let the GPS readjust itself when I took that route. And it worked just fine. And I behoove you, when you're going on vacations or business travel or something like that, don't just think I'll just plug an address in. We need to reestablish how to do some things. And I talked about this years ago when the show started. Yes, how to use a map or a Mapsco-like tool or an atlas or whatever. Because, I mean, I my first trip, you know, to Texas from Pennsylvania, I just got one of the big national atlases. And I was able to drive all the way to my friend's house. Right? I mean, it wasn't that hard. And nobody knows how to do it today. But we also need to learn how to do things like give directions. Like go right is not a good direction. Because you're not sure which direction the person's coming from. Go east, go west, go north, go south. Understanding where north, east, south, and west are. When you're going to a place you've never been before, orient yourself that if you're on this highway going this direction on this highway, which way north is? Because just because it says that you're on a highway going north doesn't mean you're actually going north. I mean, there is a place in Massachusetts where you're on 1 and 9 south and 95 north at the same time. You can't trust signs either. So, yes, Joe's talking about orienteering, but I'm also just talking about orientation, like orienting yourself as to where you are. And maybe we'll add to that in the next episode on education, because I like it. It is something that we are becoming more and more dependent on technology and less aware of reality with. Moving on, let's hear about testosterone replacement therapy from old Doc Bones.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question comes from Nick, who writes, what are the pros and cons of TRT, that's testosterone replacement therapy? It looks like there are some online doctors that'll take your lab results and consult with you about what to take, why, and then prescribe it for you. Is there any long risk of this? Or anything else to be concerned about. Thanks, Nick. Nick, telemedicine is all the rage with some practices purely remote and virtual these days, and that has its advantages and disadvantages, but it's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about testosterone. Testosterone is a hormone produced in the testicles and controlled by the pituitary gland that helps men maintain muscle mass and strength, bone density, sex drive, sperm production, and more. Testosterone also affects fat distribution, red blood cell production, and body and facial hair. What happens to testosterone levels with age? Beginning somewhere in their 30s, men start losing an average of a little under 2% of total testosterone per year. Over time, low blood testosterone levels can lead to, in some, a condition called, in medicalese, hypogonadism. The effects of a low testosterone level can be significant in 1 out of 5 men in their 60s and up to half of all men in their 70s and beyond. Testosterone replacement therapy, or TRT, aims to boost these levels back up. But TRT has had its highs and lows over the last 20 years. Prescriptions rose by 300% following media hype that proclaimed that it restored energy, alertness, mental focus, and sexual function. Now it became a sort of an anti-aging formula. Then, as risk became more apparent, particularly when the FDA ordered warning labels on TRT prescriptions proclaiming a chance of heart attack, stroke, and other blood clots, well, the number of men taking it dropped by about half. So benefits and risks are still unclear for many men. Does it improve sex drive and performance? Yes, it does, if it's due to low testosterone and not other health or psychological problems. Does it increase general levels of energy and alertness, like some claim? Well, maybe not so much. But if you have a very low testosterone level on blood tests, it's thought that TRT is a good option to prevent osteoporosis, or brittling of the bones, certain heart ailments, and other problems. Now, can you elevate your testosterone naturally? Yes, if you're overweight or obese, exercise and weight loss may boost your levels on their own. Now, if you opt for drug therapy, you can find it in the form of injection, pellets, patches, or gels. You rub gels into the skin on a daily basis. They're pretty easy to use, but you have to be careful that no one comes in contact with the treated area for several hours after you applied it. Otherwise, they could actually get testosterone into their system through their skin. There is a nasal gel that's now available that eliminates the risk of exposure to others. Then there are buccal patches, B-U-C-C-A-L. You put these on your upper gum about twice a day, and these patches are convenient but can cause irritation or gum disease. Injections, well, they're given anywhere between 2 and 10 weeks apart. They're inexpensive compared to other treatments, but they may not provide steady benefits. Your testosterone levels may go up and down, and they'll go back down between doses. Subcutaneous pellets are also available. These are inserted under your skin every 3 to 6 months, and they're very convenient once they're in, but they are a form of minor surgery. Besides heart attacks, stroke, and blood clots, you have to be aware of lesser side effects like enlarging prostate glands and urinary symptoms from them, breast tissue formation, acne, lower sperm production, and even worsening sleep apnea of all things. The bottom line, Nick, if you have low testosterone levels, you might benefit from TRT, but it's unclear, maybe doubtful, that testosterone therapy benefits men who have normal levels. Like they always say, more research is needed. Do yours and come to your own conclusions. This is Joe Alden, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, the essential guide for when help is not on the way. And be sure to get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
So I would say that I wouldn't worry about side effects at all from this. As long as you're having ongoing testing to make sure that you're not over pushing the amount. I don't see how having what would be considered a healthy testosterone level would increase your likelihood of dying. I just don't. I'll save my thoughts on medical studies here for my anchor segment here in just a minute. But no, I also do know quite a few people doing it. And one of the comments that I've heard that I was really surprised by, and it is completely counterintuitive, that people that are using it are telling me that they are calmer, more relaxed. And that's just, you know, if you think about, you know, a 19-year-old with raging testosterone, that's not what you get the image of, but older, more mature men are telling me that's the results they've had. One person who's actually very close to the show, in a way, is doing it and has said the same thing. So I think that if the levels are low and you can push them up with it, then great. But my other thing is, why are they so low? And I don't mean the general concept that as men age, testosterone levels and other hormonal levels drop. That is to some degree at least a constant in the human experience. Like, we do have certain changes we go through as part of the aging process. But we now have people that are 35 years old and a 70-year-old man in 1950 on average have higher testosterone levels. And I think where the problem comes in, and this is kind of the flaw of studies, and again, I'll save my bigger thoughts on this for my anchor segment, but what's being corrected, and then you turn around and say that the testosterone supplementation is the problem. So with all of the garbage food people are eating and what have you, if you then say, well, do people using testosterone therapy have higher incidences of these health issues? But the reason that they were used, like, so the person with the lower testosterone is more likely engaged in worse dietary behavior, just as one example. Well, of course they do. And a lot of this bullshit in these scientific journals gets skewed this way. And for every study that says one thing, you probably find one that says another. And you actually have to learn how to read things like the methodologies in the studies and read beyond the synopsis if you want the study to have any value. And again, when we get to my, you know, anchor segment, when you can't even read the study because it's not published anywhere that they let you read it, then you really just need to write it off as bullshit. Anyway, again, I think if the levels themselves are low for your place in life, that supplementing that might be a good idea. But then you also should be looking at, is it just aging and maybe you want to bring it up a little bit? Or is it the fact that you eat high fructose corn syrup and Cheetos every day? And because you can't fix one without the other and end up with a solution that actually makes sense for you. And Bones is right. People that get into better diets and exercise, those levels come up on their own. And almost guaranteed, a person in their 30s or older, a male in their 30s or older that is obese, is going to have low testosterone levels. And they're going to have other hormonal levels that are low, including things like vitamin D3. Why? Because we store that hormone in our fat. And if we keep adding fat, we keep storing what we're producing or getting. Anyway, let's move on. I got one more before it's my turn to talk. Grounding and power from Sean Mills. When we're adding, in this case, a she shed, but it doesn't really matter if it's a she shed or a man cave or a tool shed. Sean, take it away.
Hey guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead and the Hack My Homestead podcast. I've got an expert panel question today. It says, question, do I need to run a ground wire from the main panel to a sub-panel in a separate building, or should I install ground rods at the separate building, or both? Details. My wife said her two favorite words, I want, and followed that with a she shed. The 12 by 20 structure is built and on a concrete slab with an unfinished interior. While the shed is next to the house, it will be roughly 100 wire feet from the 400 amp main panel on the side of the house. There's plenty of power available. I plan to pull 4 AWG, which stands for American Wire Gauge Copper, THHN, through the conduit between the panels and feed that from a 50 or 60 amp breaker. I'm in rural Pacific Northwest, and there will be no problems hammering ground rods into the ground. The main exterior panel on the house has the utility meter and feeds both the house and the shop panels. The interior house panel is grounded back to the main exterior panel where two ground rods are located. The shop panel has two ground rods installed next to the shop and does not have a separate ground wire. None of the panels have their neutral and ground bonded. Obviously, I will pull two hot wires and a neutral to the shed. Do I also need to pull a ground wire to tie between the main panel and sub-panel grounds? Or should I have a separate ground rods at the shed and skip the ground wire, or should I do both? I notice the interior house panel has a 4 AWG copper ground wire accompanying the 4-0 aluminum hot wires. If I have to run a ground wire between panels, does it have to be the same size as the hot leads? Telling me to check local codes will not help. Much like electricity living by its own laws, I don't care much for what politicians or bureaucrats say. My house and shop sub-panels each treat grounds differently, and I have been in place for 20-plus years. I cannot believe one or the other grounded method is inherently unsafe. I'm fully capable of performing all the work myself, having done similar projects in the past. Any money saved by not running the fourth wire will be offset by the ground rods and other hardwire. I'm frugal but not cheap. I would rather spend money to do it right the first time, but the budget is not unlimited either. Bonus on-topic question. Any recommendations on buying bulk wire? I see a few online places that are cheaper than the big box stores. Once the conduit is installed, I plan to pull a string to length, remove it, and then measure the exact length of wire needed. Thank you, Eric. Hey, Eric. So this is really more of an electrical question than a solar question, but I'm happy to answer it for you with the caveat that, as you mentioned, you know, codes are different in different places. So this is the answer from a how electricity works standpoint rather than what the specific code in your area says. Let me answer the bonus question first. When I buy bulk wire, I get that from Nassau Cable. Just Google that and you'll be able to find there. They've been about the best price I've been able to find for buying spools of bulk wire. But you realistically need to be getting 500 feet or more before it's actually cheaper than just going to one of the big box stores or a local electrical supply. So about grounding, I think prior to about, let's see, it's probably 2008, if you had a separate building that was not connected to your main building with a piece of metal, so for example, a gas pipe or a metal water pipe, it was okay to put a separate ground rod in at that location and just run what's called three-wire service from your main panel to the sub-panel in the outbuilding. Then when they changed the electrical code, like I said, I think that was 08, might have been 14, something like that. They required that all of the grounds be tied back to the primary ground in the main structure. So now if you build an outbuilding, you get a four-wire connection to the outbuilding, and that ground wire ties to the main ground bus, which one way or another is going to be tied to your main disconnect, which is where your neutral ground bond takes place. The point of all of this is to provide a reference for your neutral wire so that the potential in between the neutral and your hot legs are the same, and to provide a path for tripping your breakers in the event that you have a fault. Okay, so why do they want you to have a single set of ground running wires running from sub panel to your main panel instead of each panel having its own ground rod? Well, technically there is some potential in the ground itself, and if the ground is wet, there's more. And so there's a possibility that the resistance on the neutral wire could be less than the resistance through the ground, you know, for a ground path. And in that case, you would actually have current traveling back to the source through the ground versus through the neutral wire. And so not to get too nerdy about how, you know, alternating current works and all that, what I would tell you is that for this project, it's probably easier to just pull the extra ground wire. You already have a ground bus bar in your main panel that's tied to your disconnect where the big ground bars or ground is coming in. And so that's probably cheaper and easier since you're already laying conduit to just pull an extra wire. But if you wanted to add a separate ground rod and just ground that panel in that other location, as long as the buildings weren't tied together, by metal in any way, shape, form, or fashion, in terms of how electricity works, you would be perfectly fine. Oddly enough, I actually found out about all this code change working with Nicole Sauce on her system because we were having some weird ground fault issues related to her well pump, and we put a little small solar system in to run a part of her cabin and primarily the well pump when the power was out. And those ground issues required me to do a lot of research to figure out, you know, what requirements were code and what requirements were actually based on sound electrical engineering. So those are the answers to your two questions. You guys keep getting those questions in, and I'll keep getting them answered.
Questions are like that are exactly why I have an expert council member, so I have nothing to add because there's nothing I could possibly add because Sean just knows more than me about stuff like this. So good stuff from Sean. Let's now talk about this study that I don't even consider a study because if I can't read it, it's not a study. It's words. That's all that it is. And this came from Robert, and like I said, I'm going to pick on the study and talk about deconstructing these claims that media makes, but I'm also going to answer the real question here. This comes from, I think Robert is his name. It's initial, but I think I remember talking to him before. I've not looked up the actual study. Well, neither have I, Robert, because you can't. I can't find it. I don't see it published anywhere. It's not linked from the article you sent me. But this should be looked at by health professionals. I started doing it. Until it's actually a study, no, it shouldn't. It's not peer-reviewed. It's not a study. Until it's peer-reviewed, it's not a study. And it's not even empirical evidence because the methodology is not available to be looked at. Okay, we can keep going. I started doing intermittent fast in January this year and also went back to the paleo diet. I lost 15 pounds. I wanted to lose by mid-February, but I now struggle to keep from falling below 160. You probably are a bit lightweight there, based on the next part. At 5'11", this is pretty thin for 67, so I can see where staying on a time restriction can be a problem with low lean body mass, as indicated by the article, which is not really what's indicated by the article. By eating properly, it is hard to eat enough food that is good for you in only 7 to 8 hours a day. All right, so thing about this is Robert is doing paleo, which means that Robert is eating a lot of things that are carbohydrate-based. Paleo is a much better diet than a standard American diet, but it is not a keto diet, it is not a carnivore diet, and is not heavily emphasized on fat. And so it is quite possible with an 8-hour window, if you're eating a lot of vegetables and a lot of things that are okay on paleo, that maybe you are not, in fact, getting enough calories. You're getting bulk, you're getting a feeling of satiation, but since you're constricting your eating to an 8-hour window, well, And this is where we go into this study. So Robert sent me a link to an Apple News link, and it tried to run the Apple News app and a bunch of bullshit. So I looked it up and found the underlying article that's just being, syndicated by Apple News. It's actually from the British Broadcasting Channel, which, of course, never engages in propaganda. And it is on their site called sciencefocus.com. Science TM. It's for everyone now, as long as you don't ask questions. The title of the article is Time-Restricted Eating Linked to 91% Higher Risk of Cardiovascular Death. So here's the upshot of it. They looked at 20,000 adults, and it could rock scientific consensus on healthy diets. There is no scientific consensus on healthy diets. There is certainly not a scientific consensus on intermittent fasting. In fact, it's constantly under attack. Robert's paleo diet is constantly under attack from the consensus group, and intermittent fasting is constantly under attack, and keto and carnivore are constantly under attack. So I'm already like, this is some bullshit. And finding that time-restricted eating, a form of intermittent fasting, you've just restated yourself. These people write articles that shouldn't write articles, could significantly increase the chances of death. A new study presented by the American presented to the American Heart Association. I'm going to tell you that the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, the American Diabetes Association, etc., these are all trade groups for pharmaceutical and device manufacturers. These are not speaking on behalf of doctors. They're speaking on behalf of the medical industry. They are trade unions. Just understand that. And it's not even from them. It was presented to them. Had a staggering 91% higher risk of death due to cardiovascular disease. The study which evaluated, wouldn't it be great if you just told me where I could see the study? Because the link that they give me is just a link to the, you know, like seminar, workshop, bullshit from the American Heart Association. The study, which evaluated participants' diets and health outcomes of over a maximum of 17 years, failed to identify a single cause of death for which the risk was reduced by restricting eating to an 8-hour window. They failed to identify a single cause of death for which the risk was reduced. That is not identifying that the risk of death was increased. In the end, again, cutting to the upshot here, they were talking about a 16-18 schedule, so apparently you're going to die if you only spend 8 hours a day eating. You need to spend 12. That's the upshot. But there were 800-ish deaths recorded. I'm trying to find it right now. Oh, no, there were 2,797 deaths were recorded, 840 which were from cardiovascular causes with an average age of 49. That is the extreme depth at which I'm working with here in evaluating this non-study study. Dr. Zong, who is on the board of the American Medical Association, even though his degree, his practice, and his livelihood are all in China. Why is a doctor in China, certified in China, licensed in China, who practices medicine in China, who teaches medicine in China, on the American Medical Association board? Because it's a trade union for pharmaceutical and device manufacturing companies that is not representative of doctors' interests. I'm sorry, okay? It isn't. And I know I'm doing a little bit of ad hominem here, but I don't have a lot to work with. You know, Dr. Zong is what I have to work with, along with Dr. Gardner. Dr. Zong, to his credit, from China, says that it is too early to derive any conclusions whatsoever from this shocking presentation because there's no mention of what the people ate in that window. Well, I have more questions. Who were these people? Were these big fat people who lived as fat people their whole lives and then they decided to do this for like a week and they died? And you say, how did you verify that they were truly living on a 16-8 dietary schedule? Did you just ask them? See, this is the problem with all these studies. They'll say meat eaters have a higher risk of cardiovascular disease, and you find out they include in the list of things that makes you a meat eater pizza. I'm not fucking kidding. I'm not kidding, right? This is so convoluted at a level of bullshit here. I can't really criticize the study either. I can only criticize the article for not letting me see the study. I got it, right? I can't because I don't know what they did. But I can tell you by reading a lot of these studies that a lot of times what they do is complete bullshit. These studies are data raked. They're designed to come to a conclusion that the author or the person paying for the study wanted. And so I don't know about this study, and I would take the study and throw it out, and let's talk about Robert's actual problem. He's 160 pounds, and he doesn't want to be any lighter, and he's doing intermittent fasting in paleo. Okay? Eat more food, Robert. And if you have to eat outside that window to eat more food, do it. But if you needed to lose the 15 pounds, and it sounds like you did. Now, I'm going to tell you, 5'11", if you put 15 pounds on, is 175 pounds. And when I was 5'8", and I played sports, and I worked out every day as a senior in high school, and I was only 17 years old, that I weighed about 175 pounds. And I was certainly not overweight. No one would have ever said that about me. When I got out of the Army 3 years later, again, being in an airborne unit, doing PT all the time, training, etc., I was a little over 180. And by then I'd grown a little bit more, and I was about where I am now at about 5'10". So that was, as a, you know, pretty much still a teenager. I was in my early 20s. I was 20 years old. I joined the Army at 17, got out at 20. I was like 3 months before my 21st birthday when I got out of the military. So, you know, you're going to weigh... men do not stop growing at 18. That's another lie. And we're not just about cerebral development. Men will fill out their frame of their skeletal system, their shoulder, all of that shit out till about 25 to 27 years of age. So if you are in great shape at 180... at 20, you're probably going to, if you're still in great shape, still be more than 180 at 25 if you've developed properly as a man, you know, testosterone and all that, and filling out your frame. So I think that number does seem a bit low to me, but I don't know you. Some people, like, you know, there are different body types as well. I am Ukrainian, right? I have broad shoulders. I've always had very broad shoulders. Like, and it's not because I'm fat, because there's no fat on my shoulders, right? I am short and stocky overall compared to, like, you know, a 6'1" guy. And I'm not lanky. I've never been lanky. I don't have really long legs. I'm only 5'10 because, as Nicole Sauce puts it, I have a long middle, right? So I can't say that this is too light, but it feels that way. I get what you're saying. What I would say straight out of the gate is add more fat to your diet. Because, and this is where people get confused about keto and paleo, you know, keto and carnivore. When we say something like we get, you know, 60 to 70% of our calories from fat, they think that means that we eat, if you looked at our plate, you know, like the plate diagram bullshit food pyramid crap, that 60% of the space on the plate is a big blubbering hunk of fat. Fat is far more calorically dense than protein or carbohydrate. And so a ribeye is going to derive, even though it's nowhere near 60% of the volume being fat, about 60% of its calories are from fat and 40% from protein. So I would say up your fat, right, and maybe up your protein, and increase your overall caloric intake. I will also say, the minute you go to a time restriction form of eating, your caloric intake does go down. When you go to two meals a day, or even eating in the middle of that window, you just eat less food. And so if you need to extend your window to 10 hours to keep the weight and the shape of your body that you want, go for it. But don't do it because this study says so. Because this study is not a study. It's an article by a bunch of idiots that don't know anything about what they're writing about. This article reads like the person that wrote it knows a hell of a lot less about science and biology and human diet than I do. And I don't go around writing articles for Science Focus. I don't know who this moron is, but, I mean, ChatGPT could have written this article for all we know. And then been tuned up a little bit by somebody that made it a little bit more readable for people. But, yes, you can, if you play around with your diet enough and restrict your caloric intake enough, be too thin. Again, this article means nothing. And until I see the study means nothing. Absolutely nothing. Not because of my personal bias, but because there's no there. There's no substance to this. We have a Chinese doctor who's on the American Medical Association that was part of a study review that went to the American Heart Association that has a number of 91% associated with no explanation of what that means and no explanation of what the food was, what was consumed, how long the people were on this level of restriction, where they were when they started, what their diet like was before. This is crap. This is crap. And it's why you have to be very careful about making any decision in your life about anything that comes out of media without being willing to do a deeper dive analysis into it. But you, Robert, know your body. You know the way that you want to feel. You know the weight that you want to be at. And you and your doctor should know your lab numbers, like what is your A1C? What is your blood pressure? What are all the other really important markers indicating about your metabolic health? And it does sound to me like you probably should eat more food. Now, whether that is simply eating more in your window, eating different sources of high-quality nutrition that increase the caloric intake, extending your window, or eating three meals a day instead of two. That's all up to you. But don't do it because Science Focus and their ChatGPT author tell you to. With that, let's go ahead and wrap things up for the day. I appreciate everybody tuning in today. Tomorrow we will have a Friday flashback, and it'll be a good one. I don't even know what it's going to be. I haven't looked it up yet. I've got to put it together as soon as I'm done, because I got to go take Lucy the dog to the vet tomorrow to get some stuff taken care of, which will be an incredibly traumatic experience for her. She doesn't do well with going to the doctor, and so I need to get that done. But it'll be a good one because they're all good, or they wouldn't have made it the first time around. Also, I'll remind you here at the end that if you like the show and the work that we do, you can always do your online shopping beginning at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. If you do your shopping there, no matter what you buy, you will help us. Plus, you'll find all of my reviews, all on products that I own, I used, I bought, and I would buy again, or I would recommend that you spend your money there. Also, hey, take the bioreactor composting course if you have not done so yet. Please consider doing so. It is a great course. We had close to 300 students enrolled now, I think. Nothing but positive feedback. And if you want to really take your ability to be self-sufficient to the next level, you need to learn how to build fertility and hold fertility and maintain fertility on your property. And the number one way to do that is not with chemistry, and it's not even with straight-up direct nutrient. It's with biology. And that's what's a bioreactor form of composting. We're not just breaking down organic matter into compost so we can put tons of it on per acre and try to build topsoil where it is. We're building microorganisms here. And it can sound really complicated when I put it that way, but it's not. And I'll make it understandable. And I will tell you this. One of my contemporary podcasters in the permaculture space, Billy Bond, really awesome dude, really get along great with him. He took Elaine Ingham's $4,500 soils course. My course is $40. It's much less academic, I guess. I was blown away by what he told me because I have no idea what's in Elaine's course. And she's definitely smarter than me. She's a PhD and married to a nematologist, which I didn't even know there was a specialization in PhDs that specialized in nematodes only. I mean, the lady's brilliant. I'm not putting her down. But this is what Billy said. Jack, I learned more of relevant information in the first 1 hour lesson in your course than I did in the first 10 hours of a course I paid almost $5,000 for. That's a ringing endorsement. Matt Powers, really amazing amateur soil scientist. Again, way smarter than me. Looked at what I'm doing, told my students at my last workshop, you need to go back over there and see what Jack's doing. This is next level. It looks simple, but it's deceptive how simple it looks. This is something you need to understand. I've put it all together in a way that makes it easy to understand. So check it out. It's at homefoodsystems.com. MSB members, you get $5 off. More's coming from there. Remember, there's a free course there, too, on principle-based design. You can go check that out and give us a shot for free. With that, hope you enjoy your weekend and check out that Friday flashback tomorrow. Are they going to bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.